All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the We're Kicking podcast, where I get to interview the legends and warriors of the martial arts world. Today, I am being joined by owner and chief instructor of 360 Krav Maga, Alan Pederlin.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Sweet. I got it. Sir, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. We're basically neighbors. I live basically 5 minutes away from here.
That's good. So, easy.
Yeah, really easy. Thank you. So, get things started. How was young Annan like?
Okay, that's it. Okay. But like I said, I grew up in Italy and moved here in my mid-20s. Mm-hmm. My mother moved back to the U.S. She's American.
Okay.
And so I grew up over there, studied martial arts there when I was little, like most people. And joined the Italian army, did some stuff over there. Then came here when she moved here a little bit earlier, and then joined the U.S. Army. And then there I got really involved more into the self-defense and combatives aspect. And in 2000, I started Krav Maga right out of the army. I first got exposed to it in the army after a mission. We stopped in Israel for a few weeks, and it was very impressive. It was very impressive. In Europe, it was already pretty popular, Krav Maga, especially with military units. And that's it. You know, I mean, once I started teaching, traveled to Israel, spent a lot of time over there, then came back and decided to move to Los Angeles. It was kind of the Mecca for martial arts at the time. UFC was becoming very popular. Mm-hmm. Got the chance to train with people like Basrutin and stuff in the very early days, so that it was kind of cool to see that early side. Right now, everybody's kind of untouchable.
Yeah.
But back in the day, it used to be where people just train everywhere.
Yeah, different martial arts back in the day where...
It was really different.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you either had the jiu-jitsu, you either had the wrestling, the boxing.
Yeah.
Nothing was really mixed together just at the time.
But I was lucky that I had a contact. There was a place in LA called Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu. And Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu was probably the first place that I've ever seen where... people came together. And so that's where I met Basrutin. And a lot of the people that were training at the time were training over there because Marcos Vinicius is the owner over there, and he ran a very open program. So Marco Ruas was there and a bunch of other people. So it was really fun to see the early days.
Yeah.
There's a cool documentary. I don't know if you've ever seen it, called The Smashing Machine, that it's with Mark Kerr. It's a very cool film documentary and that follows one of these champions of the UFC, but it was actually filmed partially in that place, and so it's a lot of good memories.
Oh, okay. And that was early 2000, as you said, right?
Yeah, it was early 2000, probably. Yeah. 2001, 2002.
Oh yeah, that's when the UFC was just coming up slowly but surely.
Yep.
And I mean, I want to get to all this, but how's life in Italy when you were young? Was it you said you started martial arts at a young age.
Yeah, I started with Shotokan Karate. And I mean, Italy was a great place. You know, I didn't have a rough upbringing. It was very nice. It was in a small city just outside Venice. And it was great. You know, like I said, I did karate for quite a few years. And then when I started competing and fighting more as a young teenager at that time, you know, kind of the mode of fighting kind of changed. And so I started training Muay Thai.
Oh.
And and that really kind of opened up a different kind of worms. You know what I mean? It's just because at the beginning where karate was still very competitive, but it was still karate. I did also taekwondo and things like that. But really Muay Thai is what opened a little bit more of this mixed approach to martial arts.
Yeah.
Kind of early on, more like boxing and different stuff as opposed to traditional.
Like you said, different can of worms opened up.
Exactly.
Right there.
And then when I came to the US, it really opened up even more. But even for a small town in Italy, it was cool because I found an instructor that actually traveled to Thailand. And that was like early 90s.
Ooh.
And so spent a lot of time over there, and the story where he married the daughter of the teacher and the whole kind of like out of a martial arts movie. And so it was fun.
Did you ever travel to Thailand with him?
No, I never been to Thailand. Okay. That's one of the places that I was actually supposed to go before the pandemic, and we had to cancel our flights because we were supposed to be there in March 2020.
Oh,
so that didn't work out. It's okay.
So that's on your bucket list to go.
It's fine, but hopefully before the bucket list.
Yeah, right.
But it's just never... I don't know. I've always been more attached to Europe and stuff. And I've been to Asia, just not there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I know you joined the airborne in Italy. Mm. What piqued your interest to join the
I always wanted to be in the military, honestly.
Oh, okay.
Always. So I've always been attracted by the discipline side. And also, listen, there are a lot of values that are that connect a lot with martial arts. So I wanted to... I've always loved martial arts. I'm part of the era that started martial arts also because of Bruce Lee and all the various movies of the 80s and stuff. And I felt that there were a lot of the same values like honor and discipline and tradition be embodied in the military. And so that was the ultimate way for me to kind of be part of a bigger picture and be part of something bigger than myself and still be in kind of a more of a fighting, you know, type of environment. So nurture that side.
So you had experience when you joined the airborne, you already had some kind of combat experience?
No. As far as combat, no. I mean, I only had martial arts experience.
I mean, even with a little bit, you're still kind of a tad bit ahead of the game. I mean, everybody's hungry at that age.
I always wanted to do something that matter outside of what's right in front of me. And even martial arts, I always wanted to open a school and do something one day. But I knew that I wanted to also test myself in a different way. So I've done different things through the years. I was silly and stuff, but back when I first came to the US, and it was before the army, actually, my mother used to live in New York City. I don't know if you ever heard, there was a group. I think they're still active, but back in the day, it was a little bit different, called the Guardian Angels in New York City. Okay. And there are these guys that patrol the city, very bad neighborhoods.
Oh.
And so as a 18, 19 year old, I joined this thing and I did not even speak English. And so it was just kind of fun experience to, I made some lifelong friends but also test some of my martial arts skills. A lot of them were martial artists and it was kind of a cool way to, it was interesting. Like I was a young kid teenager from Vicenza, Italy, small town of 100,000 people.
Oh, wow.
And instead, now I was in the South Bronx, you know, so it was interesting.
So Guardian Angels, you said, that's what they were called.
Yep.
So tell me more about that experience. That sounds fun.
It was very fun. It was very interesting. You know, the founder, his name is Curtis Lewa. Sometimes I still bump into him through social media, but it was interesting. Like I said, they were a citizen patrol, but it was still like in the early 90s. So there were a lot of, I mean, realistically, it was very hands-on, let's put it that way. And so, but there were no weapons. And so it was just interesting. It was kind of taking back certain neighborhoods. There was a lot of work, actually. NYPD was very supportive.
Oh, nice.
And Curtis, actually, the founder, just ran, unfortunately lost, but he ran for mayor last year in New York City. Somebody very prominent within the New York scene. Yeah. He has a radio show that is very popular there. And like I said, it was interesting. Like I said, my first week there, I remember doing these patrols, and there was a thing called the Ninth Avenue Street Festival. Yeah. And it was one of those typical street festivals that you have. But the first weekend, actually, like a bomb exploded. There was a huge fight right away because there were these gangs that took over, and it looked like out of a movie. That was my first weekend. It was two blocks where everybody was fighting. Cops, gangbangers, us. We were about 50 of us. So it was just very, that was my, like, Big Rumble in Little China, similar to, like, Kurt Russell movies.
Oh.
And so it was, that was kind of my... my coming to age, like where my fighting.
Yeah.
And, but it was interesting. And then from there, I stayed there for about 2 years.
2 years. And then you went back to Israel, no?
I went to Italy first, joined the army.
Okay.
And, I actually helped the Guardian Angels set up chapters also in Italy too.
Oh, really?
Joined the army. I did 2 years, in Italy and, was deployed to Somalia for a while. And, you know, not much hand to hand. Like I said, coming back from Somalia, we stopped in Israel.
Okay.
And before coming back to Italy, and that's when we found out about Krav Maga.
So tell me about, do you still recall seeing and going, what is that they're doing? Because
it was more the fact that even the U.S. Army for a big period, armies stopped doing hand to hand. For a long period of time. Yeah. And so even when I came to the U.S. Army, there was no hand-to-hand program, no official hand-to-hand program.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. So when I came back from there, I got more interested. When I came to the U.S. Army, right, I took a six-month vacation,
yeah,
then joined the U.S. Army. When I joined my unit, it was the 82nd Airborne in Fort Bragg. I was trying to find out more information, and there is actually the a special warfare school in Fort Bragg. And I found out that there was a course that was just starting. And so I was number 30 of instructor in the U.S. Army as far as, so it was very early days.
Yeah.
And I was able to convince my commander to send us there. So we were the first, myself and this friend of mine were the first instructors for the 82nd Airborne ever, basically since World War II. And so it was kind of interesting to at least bring that side in.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, there was what now is Army Combatives. Okay. Developing in Fort Bragg or in Fort Benning, and a link to the Gracies. And so it was kind of cool and stuff. It's obviously the Combatives program took over, but we used to do a program called Line that came from the Marine Corps. And but it was just interesting to be at that time there, because there was obviously a need, not so much for fighting skill, but more for developing soldiers. Yeah. Like I said, you want to have a soldier that can go hands-on on somebody and actually do what they're supposed to. That's great. That was kind of the main objective of training.
Yeah.
And so it was good.
And how was training? Like, was it
it was rough. Rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rough. It was very rough. Rough. But that's the thing. The main thing was really to develop, you know, I think that, a lot of times people have misconception of what the hand-to-hand training is for the military.
Yeah.
There are much, better martial artists outside of the military or outside of law enforcement, even though sometimes that's a very legitimate, it adds a legitimacy to somebody. As far, even in Israel, most of the hand-to-hand instructors are part-timers, you know, and so they're not full-time doing that. And, like I said, it was just a rough course, you know, with a lot of obstacle courses, a lot of fighting with gear on. It was really more about testing our resolve under stress. And the idea was, like I said, there was a technical, obviously we had techniques and training that we're supposed to do, but it was also about kind of creating soldiers, that could go hands on, that had that grit that is necessary to become a soldier.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Ooh, as they say, when shit hits the fan, you want those guys right there in the front.
You know, yes, but for a long time, unfortunately, the Army was going to a more video game type approach, meaning, you know, a lot of optics, a lot of stuff. They were trying to take away the fact that you're actually hurting somebody. And so, but then when it came down to actually people having to fight, that's not the soldiers that they wanted. And so that's why even right now, Army Combatives is huge. The Marine Corps has the MacMap system. Everybody pretty much has a system, and it's mainly as a leadership development program for these soldiers, not so much for hand to hand.
And all this was going on around earlier mid 90s.
Yeah, this was late 90s.
Late 90s.
Yeah, because I got I did Italian Army 94 to 96, and U.S. Army 96 to 2000.
Wow, so it's not relatively, but it's kind of still new.
It's been growing like crazy. I mean, even the Army Combatants that there is right now, it was very jiu-jitsu based at the beginning. Now it's full on MMA. They do even MMA competitions in Fort Bragg. They do, I mean, it's very about fighting.
Wow. That's
so it's very interesting.
I like to hear that, because I mean, you were part of that. You helped build that.
I don't know about help build it, but let's put it that way. I was one of the test subjects. to kind of see what works and what doesn't. And also, but not just on the soldier side, but also so much is really getting these chain of commands to buy into programs. And so I was a pain in the ass. It was a pain in the ass to actually bring hand to hand back into these units. Yes. And, the cool thing is once it got in, it never got out. And that's so great. It just continued building, and it built support and everything else.
That's great. Mm-hmm. I like that. And so, you start Krav Maga. Your instructor, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
If I butcher his name, but you started with Heinz.
So actually, I started with one of his students in New York City in Rome, Israqi, and right after the army. And the Heinz was actually his instructor.
Oh,
and so I started with Ron. I was very passionate, probably like you, about martial arts. So I started already assisting quite a lot very early. And then Haim came up from Israel We did an instructor course. I got certified through him. He invited me to go down to Israel with him. So within a month and a half, 2 months, I was in Israel at his house, living with him for a little bit.
Oh, okay.
And so he died 2 years ago now. Oh, and it's okay. It's I mean, he was older. And but it's he opened up so many doors and training opportunities, and really, you know, it was really a cool experience.
How was he like?
He was very rough. Really rough. Oh, okay. He was this very big man. He kind of looked like Santa Claus, you know, like a very big, not fit, but he was super tough. I mean, it's for me, the thing that made me fall in love with Krav Maga, and that's why sometimes when I look outside and listen, our Krav Maga, as far as 360, kind of developed through the years, in a different way in some cases. But what always stuck with me is less of the technical side. And I think that's what sometimes people don't understand and misconception, and more of the, it's really a reflection on how, it's almost like karate in Japan. Yeah. Krav Maga, you can't do Krav Maga without understanding how Israel is and how Israelis are. And so in Israel, everybody's ready for war. Everybody's in the reserves. Everybody's ready all the time.
That is correct.
And so when I went to the second time to Israel to stay with him was 2002. And it was a very tough time over there. A lot of bombings, a lot of terrorist attacks. But it was interesting to see that life goes on. And I always liked the idea of you can be a waiter in a pizza place, and the call comes, something happens, and you have to snap into place and actually report to a unit and go to war. And I think that there was a lot of, there were a lot of parallels, let's say, for self-defense, always having somebody that is not necessarily meant to be a warrior, having to fight, same way as a self-defense, where if the guy is an MMA champion or a jiu-jitsu black belt, of course he's going to be okay in most cases. But the reality is that you need to be able to create that situation where a regular person can do incredible things under stress and at a moment's notice, because they have no choice. And that's exactly what Israel is. And it's again, it's a beautiful country. And my heart is always there. Since then, I've been a billion times.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it's very interesting. And he kind of showed me around everywhere. He took me everywhere. You know, it was just very interesting.
So, I mean, you obviously were very close to him. And did he ever tell you about how he started or his instructor?
Yeah. So his instructor was the founder. So Haim was one of three, basically, senior instructors that were developed by him. And then they developed everybody else.
Yeah.
And there are different factions. Sometimes people think that Krav Maga, it's a little bit like karate. There is a million different styles of karate.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with Krav Maga. And so the Krav Maga from Haim was very fighting based. There was a lot of, like, he really liked Kyokushin karate and sparring. And so when I was there, we did some techniques. That's a funny thing that sometimes people tell me, oh, but you know, when I was there, I fought for literally, like, was there with him that time a little over a month. And we fought two times a day. It was always fighting. It was only stand-up fighting for most cases. It was still, that was the base, but it was very hard fighting. And and that's all they do, you know. And so he always brought that to the table. He was one of the guys that, together with the founder of Krav Maga, brought that system into a civilian world, because it was developed for the army first. And then in the 70s, they developed the system for civilians. And so he was always very involved with the founder until he died, you know. So,
man, that's awesome. So you said there was three of them under him, under the founder.
So there were a few, really. And then I'm sure there is more people that kind of will argue. But for the most part, like I said, the main guys that were doing black belts are Haim Zhu. There's another guy named Haim Gidon. And then there is Yalin Yaninov. And then later I connected with and I continued training with.
That is awesome. And you're mentioning about chief instructors and all that, or instructor courses. How does that go about? What does that entail?
So it really depends on where you do it. It's like, so there's two main sides of it. I'm not a big fan of instructor courses, but that's one of the reasons why Krav Maga was able to develop kind of as a worldwide phenomenon, because they're basically intensive courses. So most of the time they were recruiting black belts from other system, put him through basically a boot camp, And then come out of it as Krav Maga instructor. But because that was an army way of doing things. That's what they do in the army.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And, you know, I have positive and negative thoughts to it, but everything in Israel is controlled by the government. So the real instructor course, like I was lucky enough to do and a few others, it's actually a government mandated course. It's 3 weeks in which you also do anatomy. They do CPR and first aid. Like there's a very, it's more about the profession of being a martial arts instructor as opposed to just learning techniques. And so there's a teaching side, obviously, but you know, a lot of times instructor courses these days, they'll actually teach the system in the course. That one was more about how to teach the system. The assumption was already that you knew the material.
Right.
So it's a little bit different, the approach.
Okay. And as far as, I mean, and again, I'm very knowledge of Krav Maga.
That's okay.
Those are big, but it's very weapon based, right?
Or I mean, honestly, it depends. I think that a lot of people focus more on that because I mean, listen, in Israel, everybody carries a weapon. You know what I mean? It's just, it's, you go to a bar, remember, and maybe right now it's different, but back at that time, because they had a lot of these suicide bombers going to restaurants and blow up bars and so on, you would have waiters carrying.
Oh, wow.
And so it's, weapons were very, very prevalent. And so, you know, even soldiers carry off duty, they will carry their weapon. So everywhere. Sometimes you see people in bathing suit with an M16 or an Uzi. Yeah, because when you're in the army, you're always on. And so when you go around, you still go around with your weapon, with your service weapon everywhere. And so that obviously brought a certain level. That's why sometimes people without going there don't realize how life is over there and how much it impacted the system. Now, having said that, Krav Maga for me is always more about a mantra of approach to fighting. So in reality, like for us, for example, with 360, it's probably like 5% of the material is weapons, if that.
Right.
And because ultimately, if you cannot fight without a weapon, you cannot fight with the weapon. And so it's always an extension of other skills. It's not something that we build everything around it. And again, some people decide to, it's like some people that do regular martial arts, they'll decide to pick 3 techniques from jiu-jitsu, 2 from Krav Maga. Yeah. And so they'll pick whatever they feel like their system is missing. And usually Krav Maga will steal the weapons just because, say, I have no idea, another system of karate or whatever. Kyokushin karate is not going to have gun defenses. They'll steal it. And that's okay. Same way they will steal jiu-jitsu or judo or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Like we were just talking martial arts, it's evolving and it's been evolving. You can't have the old school mentality of, I just want to say kung fu, where your standards are super wide and why not? Because martial arts is evolving.
But I think that this thing of style, it's obviously that I think that even within the martial arts community, I'm sure you know as an instructor, if you look at, I would say, especially outside of this area, because this area is still very jiu-jitsu, there's still a lot of, like, especially with Brazilian jiu-jitsu. But otherwise, martial arts, like the old karate schools, the kempo schools that were there before, kind of everybody does everything. I think it becomes more about who you're catering to and what the objective is. If you're training somebody for a possible self-defense solution or a situation, you're going to train certain things. You have to train ground. You have to train stand up. You have to train takedown defense and you have to train some weapons.
Yeah.
And so I think that the style in a way is, for better or for worse, it's almost like doing MMA.
Yeah.
You know, it's back in the early days of UFC, you would have the Kung Fu guy versus the Ninjutsu guy versus the Jiu-Jitsu guy. Now everybody does everything. If you have to fight in a cage, you have to do all of it. And so I think that the style itself, I think even for martial arts, it will be difficult to retain, you know, it's evolving, you know, and for us as a 360, I've always been a fan of fighting. And so, I love jiu-jitsu. I think there's a lot of things that I don't like about it when it comes to self-defense, but I love jiu-jitsu. I train all the time. I think it's an incredible part of, you know, what I do. And it impacts also my stand-up training too.
Oh, yeah, it surely does. And talking about jiu-jitsu, how did you meet Leo Vieira?
I started jiu-jitsu someplace else.
Oh, okay.
And actually, he was 2 minutes from my school. And so I knew that, you know, it's always a little bit weird sometimes when you approach somebody that is local and you're a school owner.
Yeah.
Because I feel like people get a little bit defensive. I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
And so I introduced myself at the beginning, like beside him and his wife, took me in like without any reservation. It was super awesome.
They're super nice.
Some of the other instructors were a little bit kind of whatever, but it's been so long that if somebody thinks that I have alternative motive, they're just dumb because I've been there longer than most people.
Right.
And I've known Leo. Leo, I think, trusts me because I've never done anything to disrespect him or the school. And a lot of my students train there.
Oh, nice.
And so,
So, like you said, people are going to go where they're going to go. You really can't hold anyone captive.
No, I mean, but it's also, as long as you're a good person and stuff, I think it's, I think there are some bad apples, even the martial arts industry that have this ego that kind of, I mean, I think with jiu-jitsu, your ego has to go out the door right away to a degree because you can be a 10th degree in Kempo. You're going there and you're getting tapped by a Y belt.
Oh,
it's like, you know, so it doesn't matter.
Well, when you said that, I just brought back my Y belt days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still get tapped all the time and stuff. And so I've been doing it for 11 years. So it's,
One thing with me is that my jiu-jitsu instructor, he always tells me, stop laughing, Jose. Stop laughing. Take it serious. I do take it serious. It's just, I love the fact that I'm learning something new.
Yep.
That I had never done before. So getting ragdolled, as they say, or submitted, I, in a weird way, I enjoyed it because that's something new. Cause it's like they say, you do something, the same thing over and over. Eventually you kind of not get bored, but you know, you want to learn new things. And so that to me was eye-opening. I was like, I love this.
But I tell you, I love the training methodology of jiu-jitsu. I mean, I wish that sometimes the teachers had a better teaching method because sometimes I feel like the quality of teacher is improving. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, being a black belt does not make you a good teacher.
Oh, no.
And so you just have to understand how people learn. And I think that in most cases, it takes a long time for people to become black belts because people don't have a plan on how to get them there. And so it becomes very difficult as a system. I think that there are places like Art of Jiu-Jitsu in Newport Beach, even Leo and others that are trying to really systemize it and really bring some structure. I think if you have structure, you can do it in half the time and get better black belts. Because realistically, unfortunately, a lot of places you still go and the instructor will pull a technique out of his butt and decide that's what we're going to do today. Yeah. And then you're never going to see that technique again for 3 years. And so it's not going to help you. But on the other side, I like that it's all about elevating the skills you have. Not necessarily a black belt knows more techniques than a white belt. They just know their game and they know how to elevate what they know to a different level. And I think it's very difficult with stand up and traditional martial arts to do that because it's more based on you're learning one more form, three more kicks, two more punches. But I like really the idea that if I have even stand up, a student throwing a jab cross as a Y belt and you see him progressing through the various belts with that jab cross.
Yes.
That jab cross takes a completely different flavor when somebody is a black belt. And that should be about that, in my opinion.
No, I totally understand that because, I mean, like you said, I've had people that come in with no experience and a simple, like you said, jab cross, just teaching them not dropping their hands, snapping the hand back, and seeing them evolve from where they started to where they're at, it just makes you feel good. And it's, for me, it's about the patience.
Yep.
And I feel like a lot of people don't have that patience.
But unfortunately, as instructors, there are a lot of people in the martial arts industry that focus on this. For a long time, there was this thing of camouflaging repetition. And I think it's bullshit. I mean, I think honestly, the problem with that becomes that we create an ADD type environment where the students is always looking for what is next, as opposed to just trying to get better at what they do. And I think that there's a misconception because then you see it with jiu-jitsu. People are doing the same things over and over again, and they'll train 6 times a week. Yeah. When instead, the people that are worried about being repetitive with their curriculum, most cases, these people don't train that often. They'll train 2 times a week if you're lucky, and they're not going to stick with it. They're not going to develop. They're not necessarily better. They might be better as far as flexibility. Maybe their timing with kicking or with punching, but they're not really better also for in a fight, you know what I mean? In a real fight. And so I think that, I think that jiu-jitsu can teach us a lot more on, like I said, it can give us almost permission, even standing, to spend more time on things and not continuously, you know, overwhelm the student with things they're not going to be able to actually do.
That's correct. And I mean, because jiu-jitsu, like you said, you get tapped out and then you keep going and okay, we're good. where a lot of people in stand up and you find you, the first time you get punched,
yep.
it's an eye opener.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some people, I noticed, I don't know if you correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm, you see it differently, but jiu-jitsu, you get tapped out. Okay, let's keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you get choked out. Oh, okay, let's go. But you get punched. Some people go like, whoa, I did not like that.
Yeah.
Hold on, time out. Let me sit out for a bit.
Or, and sometimes you need to, like, listen, realistically, you need to sometimes sit out. If somebody rocks your brain, you should sit out. You can't do that. I mean, listen, the reality is that you cannot go at the same intensity that you go grappling. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you do it too. You go almost at 100%.
Yeah.
And you're safe. If you go at that same speed standing, especially with beginners, people will be killed.
Yeah.
And so that it becomes, there's a jiu-jitsu instructor who's one of my old instructors that said something that always stuck in my brain is the fact that one of the reasons why jiu-jitsu, in his opinion, and I agree to a degree, is so effective is you can actually train it at full speed. Where you cannot do that with standing.
No.
I mean, you can try to have the best technique in the world or whatever else, but the reality is that you cannot train it. Like if I'm doing a knife defense, if I'm doing a gun defense, if I'm doing a choking defense, if I'm doing some kind of kick or whatever, how many times I can actually do it in real life and practice it and get the experience that I need to be able to actually apply it in real life.
Yeah.
With grappling, I can do that. You know what I mean? And so that's, and it's true. That's one of the biggest benefits of ground.
Yeah. That is awesome. But also once you get hit and you get rocked, like I said, I'm probably crazy, but it helps you in a way. Cause now when you get hit again, you're like, okay, let's keep going. Or you get hit, you feel it, but you're like, all right, well, let's keep going, which I feel like, especially if you do martial arts, you need to get that hit. Whether it's the body, get your air taken out, or the face and get rocked a little bit. Cause you're going to need that. I mean, out there.
I agree.
When you're protecting yourself, you get rocked. You don't have that split second to go, I just got punched.
Yep.
You can't freeze because they're going to be bombarding you with punches or whatnot.
Yep.
And that's one of the things where, personally, when I'm teaching practical stuff, it's nowadays, it seems like everybody knows something. So I do teach the proper jab cross, but also the flailing.
Mm-hmm.
The flailing hand. What are you going to do when the flailing hand comes around? So is that something like you as yourself, you also teach, like if someone comes with a flailing hand?
Yep.
Because when I was here, you were talking about that incident that happened in, I believe, Florida, where that student pushed the other one. It's like, what do you do then?
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, but listen, sometimes the reality is, it is bad to say, but you know, the reality is that sometimes you're going to lose. And that's the biggest thing for people to digest is that, unfortunately, you cannot be ready for anything. Like I said, people die in battle all the time, like Navy SEALs, Delta Force. It doesn't matter how much training you have, it is still going to happen. And so you have to accept that. So even the fact of being tapped or being rocked teaches you that there's some things that you cannot control that are going to still happen. And you're going to have to deal with it, you know. And sometimes there's no, I have a very good friend of mine from Israel, actually, that is a more senior than me in Krav Maga. And back in the day, and he was traveling as a young kids after the army in Israel. It's a custom that they'll spend a year after the army traveling.
Oh.
So they travel the world. Some of them go to South America. Some of them go to Thailand and India, but it's very common. You know, the parents give him money and stuff and they go and travel.
That's
and,
awesome.
He was in, I remember if it was Chile, it was Peru, was picking up some money on an ATM machine. And he's somebody that knows how to fight, was involved also in fighting in the Israeli army. But he was an ATM machine and somebody broke a 2x4 in his head, stabbed him a bunch of times. And fortunately, he survived. But that's a perfect example of somebody. There's no, you can play it in your brain however you want to. We are all going to be vulnerable. I mean, so I cannot always be ready, you know. And so it doesn't matter who you are, champion or whatever. It doesn't matter. So obviously, you want to try to minimize those times.
Yes.
But again, you know, it's not an insurance policy learning martial arts.
No, just trying to have all your bases covered, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just have your bases covered and hopefully, you know, that doesn't happen with somebody. Cause unfortunately we don't have eyes behind our head. So
no.
Yeah.
No, but I think the training does give you some control and some confidence. But again, it's like the army was the same way, is knowing what you can control. And again, and knowing when you can't and kind of, and it is what it is. And that's, and it also helps you deal with sometimes if you do get in a situation and maybe you didn't do what you were supposed to, as long as you know that in a certain situation, you're not going to be able to do certain things.
Yeah. I mean, just the top of my head, it just came to me. You can never be prepared. I saw a video of this guy walking, and some guy was behind him, coming up to him, and some guy in front of him walking towards him. The guy behind him got him in a rear naked choke.
Mm-hmm.
Super quick.
Yeah.
Super quick. And the other guy started taking the stuff out of his pocket.
Yeah.
As you know, 6-7 seconds to get put to sleep. That's how long it took. And boom, they just dropped them. They left. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you do then? Like, that thing surprises you. I mean, you could be on your phone. You could be texting. You could be walking. And you, because that's not, nowadays, if you walk around, that's why you see people on their phones, walking head down. So somebody comes behind you. Boom.
Yeah.
There you go.
But I think there is also this misconception that, listen, for me, the people that talk about, and I've always have a love-hate relationship with the self community, because obviously I hate it. And so I think it's something necessary because I love teaching people and helping people develop a passion that automatically is going to make them also safer.
Right.
But I think self-defense community is full of shit. It's completely antiquated. But not because of the techniques. It's just the training method. I think we're, by the way, even the jiu-jitsu community too, that right now is getting more into the self-defense aspect. Yeah. They're teaching techniques sometimes that, I mean, listen, right now you see the athletes in jiu-jitsu, the bigger, the better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, they used to be, using the energy, but realistically these guys come out full on steroids, strong as hell. You can go to most of the schools, even in the area, you see some freaking people that are animals.
Yeah.
So then we're trying to apply certain techniques that maybe are meant for a certain type of person. And now we apply it to a 100-pound woman that has never worked out for all her life and she's 40 years old. We have to be realistic with her. You have to build that person, you know? And so, and people look for places. Like sometimes I'll teach a class and people tell me, oh, but I didn't want to work out. I don't want to sweat. I just want to learn something. And I tell them that this is not the place for them. It's just simple as that. You know, I mean, there are plenty of people that will teach bullshit, but it's like, you know, you cannot, there are three layers of, to me, for getting safe. The technical is the last one, the one that takes the longest. I mean, realistically, the one that starts the moment, especially with women come in my opinion, is the emotional side, meaning be a little more assertive. Don't kind of talk under your breath. Look up, you know, speak with a certain way. So even when you're calling combination and tell them call, go, or two, or whatever, that's the step number one, because that can be achieved in one class. Step number two is the fitness level. If you are stronger, you're automatically safer. And that will take you maybe a month, maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months, depending on how the person is deconditioned. But if you are safe, you want to be safer. If you're stronger, you're automatically safer. I mean, that's just the way it is. I'm not saying you have to choose one or the other, but within the scale, you want to work on all three. And then the technical side, it takes time. I mean, it's bad to say, you know, but it takes time.
It does.
And so if it takes, if somebody trains once a week, and you know what? It might not arrive, just because once a week, the reality is that you're always, it's like trying to get fit. And you're training once a week. You're not going to be able to get fit. You're always sore and frustrated. You're not going to be fit. And so it's the same thing with self-defense, with fighting, with anything. If it's golf or whatever, if you want to be good at something, you have to embrace it a certain way. And so, like I said, those three tiers, I try to push it into the school, because we don't do a lot of push-ups, a lot of stuff, but we do a lot of punching, a lot of kicking, a lot of grappling. Right. And because I want that person to be physically where their functional fitness relates to what we do. And so, and like I said, in the technical side, at the end of the day, it takes a long time.
It does.
You know, nobody's going to say, it's like, oh, look, that guy is a green belt in Taekwondo. Nobody's going to get scared.
Yeah.
Because realistically, black belt in most systems is really the beginning.
It is. Oh, no.
And so what happens though, when I have a woman that is scared, it's maybe intimidated by the world around her. Maybe she's been in a bad situation, or it can be a teenager in school or somebody. You know, the technique is not going to help him, but if I can instill some confidence, if I can instill some physical fitness that helps that person, that kid, that adult, whoever, feeling more comfortable about themselves, automatically they're safer. And and then we build everything else on top of that. Also, because without confidence, technique is not going to matter. You're not going to have the confidence to actually do it under stress.
Yeah, that is, that's a big part of it, the confidence. Because I do see a lot of people like shoulder down, head down. Or when you talk to them, they talk soft. And I'm like, okay, we could work on this. And yeah, that's the first thing. That's why for me also making someone either smile or laugh. Because once you get that, you have their trust and now they built up from that.
Yeah.
And they build up with, like you said, just saying something loud, even your name, like saying your name loud, like that's a big, also big step and whatnot. So I like that point of view. Yeah. I like that. Now going back to, 360 Krav Maga, how did that name come about?
So 360, it's the actual company is called 360 Self Defense.
Oh, okay.
And then we did a, you know, we changed the name at the very beginning, but it was actually in New York. I was still there and I started teaching a lot of privates, a lot of stuff. And I came up with 360, just kind of the idea of covering all angles of fighting. So that's why 360. And so, and then from there, like I said, it just developed, you know, I mean, realistically, there are other people around the world that use 360. They don't do a worldwide trademark, but you know, pretty much we've done a good job at least bringing a certain idea. Where my goal, it was more to see, there are the diehard people in Krav Maga and martial arts that always think, oh, but you know, this thing is not Krav Maga. This thing is jiu-jitsu. For me, the goal is to, for 360 to really be seen more as a style of Krav Maga that incorporates a lot of fighting. Right. And that's really our thing, where either you can do or you cannot do. And my instructors, I have guys that are, and girls that are jiu-jitsu black belt. There are kickboxers, there are traditional martial artists in Kenpo or Ganozwa, and everybody kind of brings their tools in. I want 360 to be more of a filter that allows them to figure out, do I really need a 720 kick to kind of like, you know, because even in jiu-jitsu, realistically, there's a lot of wasted time on things that does not pertain to self-defense. Now, I think that a lot of time it's important to figure out, what is your school and what is your school is about? So for us, the Krav Maga really just keeps us more focused on the self-defense aspect. And 360 is how we bring things in. And, you know, if I spend, I mean, if I have two classes a week that an adult trains and I spend time doing a spinning hook kick that they will never be able to do, or a guard with a lapel or something like that, that they're never going to be able to do, it's a waste of their time. I missed an opportunity to impact that person and deliver on my objective. So what I try to do is to, this, we do boxing drill, we do things. Not everything has to be, but there has to be a reason that is tangible in that context. And so everything we do at the school with 360, it, like I said, it's a filter of what we want people to be able to use in their classes.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's, I like that.
Yeah, you know, so that's kind of the story behind it.
Yeah, I like that. That's cool. And you have different schools, right?
Yeah, so we have about 30 schools, and we have a couple in Europe and U.S., obviously, Mexico. We had one in Asia, but unfortunately, it didn't make it through COVID because it was in Singapore, and they had a lot of problems over there with the lockdowns until a couple of months ago. And so, but it's nice, you know, I mean, my goal, honestly, that is my goal. Like I said, right now I have a smaller school in Long Beach than I used to have. I'm super happy with it, you know, because I always wanted to have a school. I feel like sometimes bigger is not better. Right. And, it allows me to actually, I know every single student. I teach a ton of classes and that's what I love to do because otherwise when I'm going to be home eating stuff and being silly. And I also want to make sure that for my affiliates, I try not to make it less of a business and more kind of a partnership as far as the martial arts side, where I want to know that if I'm telling him, listen, I want you to, this is how I teach the kids. This is how I teach the adults. This is how he teaches material, is proven in class. I think a lot of times right now people are doing curriculums and things that they have no idea how they're actually being digested at a school level or by a beginner. And I always want to make sure that I see how my beginners, my intermediate, my advanced students digest the curriculum before I send it out to the affiliates.
Got it. And so if somebody comes up to you and said, I would like to be an affiliate, what do you, obviously they had to, do they have to train under you for a certain time and you have to see what, what
they're about? So they'll come to, I do these master classes a little bit all over the place, sometimes here and sometimes other places. They come, they train. I tell them, listen, come and train because you want to be my affiliate, but you never even met me. So right. what, you know what I mean? Right. Just because you looked at three things online, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So come, you know, it's I had one student in England that I've not trained with just because he was a student to one of my students, one of my friends, I should say, not my students, my friend. And so he's been through a certification process that I know, and he comes very recommended. So I haven't had the chance to go to see him. He's the only one. But otherwise, everybody else, I tell him, don't worry about the certification. Worry about training. Right. And so I personally think that even long distance, if somebody is committed, they can do it. It just takes a certain type of person.
Yeah.
You know, it's right now, you know, the beginning videos and things were frowned upon. I honestly see people learning a lot better by video than in class sometimes. As long as they have the discipline and a partner that they can work with, you know, it's, I don't see that big of a deal. I think that it gives them more of a chance to train more, to look at more details, to really be focused on one aspect. So even with my students, usually we focus on one thing per week. From all the different schools, and they work on it. I get an incredible amount of videos back.
So
that alone, I think, helps tremendously. People kind of develop. And so, and then I go and see them, you know, every so often.
That's pretty cool. And, excuse me. What do you look for in them to become an affiliate? Like,
you know, it's tough, you know, it's a, I mean, I definitely look for commitment, you know what I mean? It's just, I think that the martial arts industry turned into kind of a pansy industry in some cases because everybody's looking for a quick way to fill their classes.
Right.
And I think that we forget that sometimes you have to actually be good, you know, to be able to teach. And so I think that the big thing is that I want people to be better than me, realistically. I'm now 51 years old. I want people to be better. You know, I mean, I'm hoping if I'm not able to help somebody be better than what I am, that means that I fail my job. You know what I mean? Because if I have this dream of having 360 survive past me, that means that people have to be better than me. Otherwise, it's going to die with me.
Yeah.
And so I want to try to give as many training opportunities. I try to get also instructors that are cross training. I don't care how good they are in the 2 days they spend with me. I just care that they're better. Every time I see them for 2 days, they're better than the time before because that tells me that they're training in between.
Yes.
And so if training is not part of their mantra, then I don't want to deal with them. And unfortunately, I've had plenty of instructors that I had to tell them to not, they couldn't be part of 360 primarily for that. Not because they didn't train with me, because they didn't train. And most instructors just use excuses of why they cannot train. And it's all bullshit.
Yeah. And as far as the teaching goes, Do you sit down and see how they teach? Because obviously you can only learn so much from a person in like a few days. So just their teaching, because like I said, for me, teaching the patience, the understanding that, okay, this person could do this, how far you could push one person and the other one, okay, you know, I understand that person. I understand where they're coming from. So everybody thinks teaching it's easy, but
it's not easy.
It's not. I mean, it's not.
I mean, I don't think it's easy and stuff. I think, I mean, we definitely talk about teaching. We talk about format. We set up actually formats with the school where honestly, I don't tell people what they're supposed to be teaching.
Got it.
To me, it's like, if I have Jose as one of my black belts and I feel like you have the same values as me, I don't care if you teach exactly what I teach because I should not have given you my black belt. Or like, you know what I mean? It's just, so I want to make sure that I also give a level of trust. One of the things that I try to do is I want to make sure that they're not doing a cookie cut of what I do. Sometimes this thing is like, it's good to be organized, but I don't want people to feel like they're part of a McDonald's. You know what I mean? It's just, and ultimately if you, this is something, again, I tell my students and my instructors all the time that are under me, I tell them, you know, you can't have great chefs at McDonald's. If you're a great chef, you don't want to work at McDonald's.
Right.
If you work at McDonald's because you don't know what you're doing, so you need somebody else to kind of set up the structure. And so I want to make sure that the instructors are able to make mistakes. Obviously, I want to make sure that they cover the basics, like obviously how to develop a lesson plan, how to transmit information. We try to give guidelines primarily on how to set up the class as far as timing, that it also is helpful for them. Because it doesn't say exactly what to do, but we have a certain amount that we do for striking, a certain amount for grappling, a certain amount for technique. The warm-up is pretty static. It's always the same. And so we try to cheat a little bit as far as that. But as far as the expertise of that person, you know, I want the person to kind of show their personality. Yeah. And obviously they do a small course with it as far as specifically for teaching. It's not an instructor course. It's more of a workshop that focuses really on how to transmit information.
Got it.
And, some people are already very good. I have some people that are 7 degrees in karate or something like that. So they already know what they're doing. They have big schools. So they just want to be able to incorporate 360 in what they're doing. And, so it's no place of mine to tell somebody with 500 students, you're not doing what you're supposed to. They obviously know what they're doing. My goal is to kind of guide them and their instructors on how to include, in some cases, a more modern approach to martial arts than what they're doing. You know, because I wanted to feel that, you know, I wanted to feel like if they're with 360, they can add, like I said, I have one of my guys in Flagstaff that is, I'm very close to too. He's tremendous. He's a black belt already, but he's also, I don't know if you know Bill Superfoot Wallace.
Yes.
So he's Bill's second in command.
Oh.
So he's one of the board of directors for the system and everything else. So he's an incredible martial artist. I mean, he's incredible.
Oh.
And, and so it's super for me to tell him how to teach. What I'm doing is I'm helping him with 360, and he has 360 and Flagstaff, how to be able to include more things. I wanted to feel like, hey, I can include some aspects of jiu-jitsu in. Because, I mean, listen, if you're doing Muay Thai and you're doing ground, you're not doing Muay Thai.
Right.
If you're doing jiu-jitsu and you're doing stand-up, punching, you're not doing jiu-jitsu. So we have a freedom to be able to include what we need, not just, we don't have this cage built around us on what we can and cannot do. We want to be able to have a structure that allows us to teach what we have to and what we need to do and not, you know, and then how those parts come together. You know, so that's kind of the big thing.
Wow. I like that. Yeah. If you're training jiu-jitsu, but you want to train Muay Thai, I like how you said that because that is, it is true. I mean, and everything. And like you said, you also encourage your students to cross train. I think
that's
for me, that's very important because obviously I only know X amount of knowledge. So if a student comes, tells me, hey, I'm training over here. I'm like, great. How's it going? Are you enjoying it? Do you like it? As long as you're enjoying it, go for it, man. Because I know he's going to benefit from it and he's going to be happy. I really, I can't really tell him, don't go over there.
No, but you can, but it's like, you know, you can't, you just can't do that. Yeah. I mean, these days you can't do that because you also force people to be dishonest because they, you know, because somebody one day is going to be invited in an open mat by a friend or something like that. Yeah. And then they're not going to tell you, I'd rather know. And it's okay. I'd rather know also because sometimes I want to also protect them. It's like, listen, don't go to that place. If you want to do jiu-jitsu, go to this other place because that place is dangerous.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, I've had one of my students go to a jiu-jitsu place, local, that I don't know the owner. I've only met him once. Yeah. But she's first time, she's like in her early 40s, first time ever does jiu-jitsu and whatever. And they had a role for 2 hours.
Oh.
I don't even know what the hell she would do for 2 hours because she doesn't know anything. And so just put her on a gi and just, they did a little bit of technique and they literally rolled for 2 hours. And so then you gotta be really, you know, like you're one step away from getting injured. You're getting frustrated. Like, I don't understand what the objective is of being like that. So, and she didn't tell me. She just went. She told me after.
Oh, wow.
And because a friend of hers invited her in and she hated it. And so it makes no sense. But that's what I mean. There are a lot of schools like that that I would rather. There are plenty of jiu-jitsu schools that I like, but that one.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of people sometimes call it like, do you guys teach jiu-jitsu? And I'm like, you know what? We teach martial arts, we teach karate, but I have some local schools that teach jiu-jitsu. And I give them the direction. You could call these three schools, because the local schools are obviously the ones that we talked about. And, I don't try to, like you said, I don't try to bring them in because I know they want jiu-jitsu.
Exactly. No, because I know, as you said, the expectation, I think too often there's this thing of trying to kind of trick the person into it's, I don't know. Like I said, it's just, and I'm so surprised that some of the schools talk back about other schools and so on. I think that, and it's all because they're trying to get a student. It's like I said, there's a lot of weird things out there. I think, like, I'm with you. You know, if somebody is not looking, people come and tell me, oh, I want to fight or whatever. Right. But listen, there are some great people here that do more MMA stuff that you're interested in. It just makes no sense for you to come to me because that's not what I'm going to teach you.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people. So a lot of people want different things. So I'm like, you could try a class with us. If you enjoy it, awesome. If you don't, there's other options out there. And I just hope that if you came here and you tried out your class, that you left with a little bit of experience and with a good experience at that. Yep. And if you want to go join somewhere else, I know most of the instructors all around the area. So they're all great people.
Yeah.
They're all great people. You're going to be in good hands.
Yeah.
I just not going to tell them, oh, no, stay here, stay here. Because it's not, at the end of the day, they're not.
They're but gonna, I think that listen, if the business model is based on you being the only game in town and kind of putting everybody funnily into you, you're going to lose. I mean, ultimately, I do feel like there is enough for everybody and it's not like I think that sometimes martial arts instructors are so defensive when at the end of the day, like for us in Long Beach, we're in a city of 450,000 people, you know what I mean? It's just, it's like, I'm not successful because some other people are not successful and vice versa. Right. And so I actually think that if there are more successful schools, we'll create a demographic that is more active and more acceptive of martial arts. And then everybody's going to be good, at least the good instructors.
Yeah.
And so, but, I think that a bad experience will turn off that person forever for me or you.
Yes. That's exactly correct. Which first impressions, like they say, first impressions. And if like that young lady that went in, rode for 2 hours, that's the first bad impression. And after that, it's going to be kind of hard to switch around.
But I say sometimes people get a little bit, it's good that people get brave and stuff. And I think that it's, I don't think there's ever been a time with so many adults training martial arts, honestly, because like, I think I told you when I started here, it was like two schools, you know, it's and most of, you know, right now there are jiu-jitsu schools everywhere, MMA schools and Muay Thai and boxing, even fitness boxing, but just combative sports, let's call it that way, they're everywhere. You know, not just for kids like it used to be early on, but also for adults. I mean, we have about half of our students are adults. And like I said, it's just, it's they, you know, some of them cross-train also at jiu-jitsu places, some at my jiu-jitsu place, some of them at others. I know those people obviously very well. You know, it's, I think it's good. You know, it's, there's enough for everybody.
There certainly, especially in Long Beach. It's a big city, but still you, big city, small world, because just yesterday I ran into somebody I haven't seen in years and like, what? Like, how would you, I thought you were in Germany. Like, no, I'm back in Long Beach. So I'm like, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So Mr. Allen, how could people find you? Where are you located?
Listen, I'm located at 3050 Woodruff here in Long Beach. My website is 360krav maga.com and my Instagram is 360allen. So everything is pretty much 360. And it's pretty easy. Like I said, it's just 360krav maga.com is probably the best way to get in touch with me.
So I like to do this because I like basically putting the ball in your court now, throwing you a little bit off your feet. Any parting words before we leave, like any words of wisdom that you would like to give out?
I don't know about words of wisdom. So, I mean, it's, listen, I think, you know, I think it's podcasts like this are a good way to see the behind the scene of what's, what goes on in the instructor's head. And hopefully even for people that maybe are not, already in this world, it allows them to kind of understand a little bit better what goes behind the scenes. I think that, you know, I think that the important thing is to kind of, as long as an instructor has good stuff going in his brain and it's not just about business and stuff, I think they're going to be, have a good impact on students. And that's it. Like I said, it's just pretty simple.
Oh. Well, Mr. Allen, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. I love the studio, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
You said it's smaller and you like smaller and better.
I love small.
But this is nice. I like how everything's set up. It's awesome. Well, sir, thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.